Welcome to the Beef Watch Podcast. I'm Aaron Berger, a Nebraska Extension educator. For today's podcast, we're going to discuss an article from the April issue of the Beef Watch newsletter titled Nebraska Cattle Health Update, Bovine Tularemiosis and the Asian Longhorn Tick. To have a conversation about this, I'm joined today by Dr. Matt Hilly, who's a diagnostic veterinarian and pathologist at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and also a Nebraska Extension specialist. Thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Aaron.
Dr. Hilly, we have heard about this disease in states to the east of us, and it's recently been identified in Missouri, so it's not very far away from us geographically. Tell us about the two factors that impact cattle producers and bovine tularemiosis, and also how Asian longhorn tick is a vector for that.
Yeah, so the article kind of deals with those two things, and they are separate but related, right? So the Asian longhorn tick is just that, a tick that can serve as a vector for Tularemia orientalis, which is a protozoal parasite. Essentially, how it's worked since introduction into the U.S., which hasn't been all that long ago, less than a decade, where the tick establishes populations, there tends to be quite a bit of tularemiosis, which is then the disease that we see in cattle. And so we've seen this east to west spread of the tick and thus also the disease. As it moves closer, it certainly becomes something to think about for the state, but also as we bring in cattle from states to our east.
As we think about feed yards in Nebraska, obviously lots of cattle are brought here to put on feed and take to harvest. So really, it's probably likely we're going to see and have seen this occur in feed yards before we see it occur in a cow-calf operation. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think there are, in my opinion, two different risk factors there, or levels of risk when we're talking about feed yards versus cow-calf. So you're right, we are and have seen it in feed yards, particularly cattle that are brought in specifically from Virginia, but also some other states that are east and south of us. So even Missouri, we've seen cattle come in from there and see it in the feed yards. We don't really know exactly what sort of impact that's having on the health status in the feed yard, but there's strong suspicion that, you know, we're going to see increased morbidity and mortality from other diseases in cattle that are positive for Tularemia. It is essentially an anemia, so it destructs red blood cells. So what happens in the big picture is essentially many organs are starved of oxygen. So you get kind of a non-specific overall sickness, if you will, which may, and I would suspect likely does predispose them to other diseases, you know, such as BRD, which would be what we'd worry about mostly in the feed yard. So we have definitely seen it. It's something to be aware of in the feed yard when you're bringing cattle in from those areas. And then on the opposite side of that coin, for it to be established in cow-calf herds, I think to get routine exposure, you really have to have the tick. If we look at historically what's happened, there are some models that we talk about in the Beef Watch article that kind of predict the environment that would be conducive for the tick to establish. And it seems like if any parts of Nebraska would be potentially suitable, it wouldn't be very much of the state. So I think our long-term risk to the cow-calf herd, at least as of now, seems low because we probably won't be very suitable for the tick, at least on a statewide basis. But you certainly could be bringing it in if you're purchasing cows, for example, from a southeast state. So something to be aware of in that regard. We worry about the tick, but there is the potential for mechanical spread too. So needles, for example, if we're vaccinating cows or calves, regardless if they're positive carriers, we can, in theory, at least transfer it via needle because we're transferring minute amounts of blood to new animals. We don't really know what that risk is, how strong it is, but it'd be something to be concerned about too when you're talking about even on the cow-calf side. Although, again, I think it's fairly low risk when we're talking about the cow-calf sector for Nebraska.
This disease sounds a lot like anaplasmosis. How do producers differentiate between the two?
Yeah, you're exactly right. For all intents and purposes, from the clinical level and when you're looking at animals, they are effectively, they lead to the same overarching kind of disease. So an anemia. It's two separate, one's a bacteria, one's a protozoa, but you get the same result in that there are anemias, they lose red blood cells. Clinical animals can be jaundice or icteric, so they'll have yellow around their eyes, mucous membranes. And then when we do necropsies on some of these, they're going to look, or they can look virtually identical, grossly at least. So very yellowing to the tissues.
So in case of the anaplasmosis, we're talking about a bacteria. When we think about Tularemia, we're talking about the protozoa. Is that correct?
Yes, yeah, yep. Technically, that is a more of a technical difference between the two, but they both, like I said, are kind of doing the same thing. They rely on living within cells, and then causes this anemia. With Tularemia, we can see decrease in white blood cells as well, but the clinical disease that we usually see is from the anemia or the loss of the red blood cells with Tularemia.
Would these two be treated differently then as we think about therapeutic methods to try to help cattle through it?
Yeah, so there's less evidence of any efficacious treatments or things that work for Tularemia. There's some questions on even Anaplaz, frankly, on how realistic we can knock down these chronic carriers compared to what we thought in the past. But really, for Tularemia, if it's a clinical animal, it's really just supportive care, minimizing stressors in them so they can hopefully get over the acute phase of it. In both cases, most, if not all, animals do become lifelong carriers, whether or not they're clinical. And that's kind of a unique thing with the Tularemia too, as we look to these eastern states that have had it become more endemic, if you will. Take Virginia as an example. In their cow-calf herds, when they first get it in a naive herd, they'll actually see death loss in the adult cows. And then that usually progresses to some abortions and then to seeing clinical calves, nursing calves, before the herds become kind of acclimated, for lack of a better term, to it. Then they see decreases in these morbidities and mortalities. But effectively, most, if not all, of those cows then are carriers and then can be a source for future naive animals.
Once an animal becomes a carrier, is that going to impact its performance throughout its life? Or for animals that get exposed early, thinking here about calves or things like that, do they build an immunity and then kind of just go on and live normally?
That's a good question. From the production side, in terms of, say, weight gain, based on what I've seen, I don't think there is a difference in these calves that are affected with Tularemia. What we don't know is what sort of impact it has on morbidity from other things. Like I said earlier, BRD, are these animals more susceptible to developing pneumonia? Just anecdotally, it seems like that may be the case. That's kind of something we're trying to look at, and put more of a number on that, I guess, if you will, because it's not uncommon for these positive pens that we've had to be also pens that have had increased morbidity, and or mortality relative to other pens in the yards.
So, because this is a new disease, it's kind of handled a little differently in terms of reporting than maybe common diseases are. Share with us a little more about that and why that's important to know.
Yeah, so it is a reportable disease in Nebraska. So, as a diagnostic lab or as veterinarians who, if they use other labs, it is a requirement to notify the Department of Ag regarding Tularemia.
Let's shift gears now and talk a little more about the Asian longhorn tick. And while we've seen it in other states to the east of us, it's not yet been identified here, but we are on the lookout for that. So talk a little bit about what people might be looking for if they suspect that they might have that tick on their livestock.
Yeah, so it's going to be a risk to bring in on animals, even from, these parts that I've mentioned that have a more established population. I think it is important to note that while some of these more westerly or western locations where they found the tick doesn't necessarily automatically mean that they have an established population. Just for that reason, it can be brought in from animals on a truck. But if the environment in that area isn't suitable for the tick, you don't actually get a realistic established long-term population. But nonetheless, it's certainly important for folks to be aware of the tick in Nebraska and be on the lookout for it. There are some subtle differences with this tick versus others. They are very small ticks, pre-blood meal. Of course, they're a sesame seed is what I've seen referenced a lot of times. So they are very small. We do offer tick identification at our diagnostic lab. So if folks see a tick that they, can look up images of the Asian longhorn tick, and if they think it's similar, people can submit it to the lab here for identification. And if there would ever be any suspect Asian longhorn tick cases, then we would forward those on to the National Veterinary Services lab for confirmation. But that is something that we offer here.
If someone thinks they might have that on their livestock, what's a process they should go through to collect the specimen and make sure it arrives in a good identifiable state?
The first thing I guess I would recommend is getting in touch with a veterinarian. We do have on our article recommendations for sampling these ticks and how they should be submitted. So, in sealed containers and then submerged in 70% ethanol or alcohol is the sample of choice.
You mentioned a little bit about the climate that is conducive to build a long-term population of these. What needs to be in place for this tick to gain a foothold and maintain a population?
So the forage, the general landscape and the climate overall is important, but humidity seems to have a large impact on whether or not it's suitable for the tick as well. So, like I said in the article, we reference a paper where they used models to predict these things, and they had different thresholds on these models to where they would expand and become more conservative in their mapping or more strict. And it's kind of interesting where you can see as they adjust that threshold, what parts of the US would or would not be included as being suitable. And like I said, of those in the paper we reference, there's only two models out of the three that have any portion of the state at all. And the one that has the more geographic area labeled as, potentially suitable in our state is the most lax or the most liberal of those models. So that's good news for us. I think at the end of the day, what that means is that if we ever do have any sort of a location where we do get establishment of the tick, it more than likely will be in a very small portion of the state. Hopefully none, but as we've seen this progression of the tick from the East Coast, it's not impossible.
Dr. Hilly, what other things would you encourage folks to know about either the Asian longhorn tick or this disease that they often can be a vector for?
I think the biggest thing for our current situation is just kind of what we're doing here now is create awareness of it, especially in feed yards. If you're seeing clinically ill animals that are jaundice or icteric or have yellowing of some of these around the eyes, around mucous membranes, to be aware that it is a possibility, especially in the feed yard, and know that we can test for it. So we can determine the status of individual animals in suspect cases like that. The clinical signs are going to be pretty nonspecific. Like I mentioned, it's multisystemic disease. So there really isn't any specific clinical signs that we would expect to see other than just your quote unquote sick cattle. Beyond the icterus or the jaundice, there's not really anything that would tip a person off. If you're a feed yard though, and you're having increased morbidity and you're getting cattle from these areas that are known to have it, there's a very good chance that some of these animals are going to be carriers. We look at some of the serologic data looking at exposure essentially in Virginia, for example, and in a handful of years, it went from relatively low to the vast majority of herds having a large number of positives and the herd itself being considered a positive herd in a relatively short period of time. So if you're importing calves from, say, Virginia, there's a real good likelihood that some of those are going to be carriers for Tularemia.
Well, Dr. Hilly, thanks for your time today and for this update. Again, I think something for producers in Nebraska to be aware of, as well as surrounding states, and I guess kind of be on the lookout specifically for the Asian longhorn tick, as that could be something we have not yet discovered here, but should be aware of.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, for more information on the topic that we did discuss in today's Beef Watch podcast, you can find this article at beef.unl.edu. The title of the article: Nebraska Cattle Health Update, Bovine Tularemiosis, and the Asian Longhorn Tick.